Coming up, calls for churches to lead a new movement to help the country's 2 million prison inmates and former prisoners. Also, we analyze the week's top religion news. And from West Africa, Ghana's joyful Christian funerals and so-called fantasy coffins, each representing the lifetime achievements of the deceased.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics Newsweekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company. The estate of William J. Carter, the Jane Henson Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Welcome, I'm Bob Abernethy. It's good to have you with us. Evangelicals are expected to play a key role in the upcoming South Carolina GOP primary, where they make up about 60% of the likely voters. Several candidates are hoping for a strong challenge to frontrunner Mitt Romney, who won about a third of the vote among self-identified evangelicals in less conservative New Hampshire. Rick Santorum, who's Catholic, won about a quarter of evangelical votes there. Also, for some voters, especially some evangelicals, Romney's Mormon faith remains an issue. Meanwhile, a new poll of Mormons in the U.S. shows that many feel their religion is misunderstood. According to the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life, close to half of those surveyed say Mormons face a lot of discrimination. A majority say Americans know little or nothing about the Mormon faith, but a majority also sees a growing acceptance of Mormonism. More than half say the country is ready for a Mormon president. Another Pew poll released this week shows a dramatic increase in the percentage of Americans who see tensions between the rich and poor. Two-thirds of Americans say there's a strong or very strong conflict between these groups. That's nearly a 20% increase from 2009. Although Democrats and political liberals are more likely to see this conflict, the number of Republicans who agree, 55%, has also grown. In a unanimous decision this week, the U.S. Supreme Court affirmed that religious groups have the right to hire and fire their religious leaders without government interference. For the first time, the High Court explicitly recognized a, quote, ministerial exception to anti-discrimination laws. The justices said under the Constitution, religious groups can choose who will preach their beliefs and carry out their mission without having to justify those decisions to the state. At the same time, however, the court said it was reluctant to adopt a rigid formula to determine exactly who is a minister covered by the exception. A broad array of religious groups praised the decision, calling it the most important religious freedom case in decades. This weekend of remembering Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr., we take note of those calling for a new kind of civil rights movement. It's on behalf of prisoners and former prisoners. Advocates say mandatory sentences, most often for drug offenses, force unfairly long prison terms for those convicted. There are more than 2 million people in prison in this country, nearly 40% of them black. Many of them and their advocates want more ministries for those in prison and much more help from churches for former prisoners now trying to keep from going back. Deborah Potter begins her report in Akron, Ohio.
At first glance, the Front Porch Cafe could be any neighborhood coffee shop. But the makeshift kitchen isn't quite up to par. And those guys at the grill aren't your typical cooks.
I actually have a small felony on my record. Well, it's still a felony. And I know how hard it was for myself to get jobs.
Since I had my felonies, I've been having real poor jobs. I chose to do street life, and street life is nothing but trouble. Death, jail, or, you know, both.
Most of the workers here are ex-offenders. The cafe is run by South Street Ministries, a Christian fellowship that also offers Bible study for inmates.
What are they doing for, like, housing for, like, ex-felons?
A place to live, a job, even just a welcome home are hard to come by when you've been where some of these men have been.
I've been arrested 117 times. I've been shot 4 times. I've been convicted 12 times.
We want fast money, okay? So consequently, I went to prison for 10 years for aggravated robbery, okay? Behind that aggravated robbery was drugs.
Perry Clark now runs a construction business. Michael Starks is a community organizer. Both former drug users say they went straight after finding faith behind bars, but that when they were locked up, the churches they knew were not on their side.
The church was of the mindset that, hey, he did wrong, he's being punished. They thought that if you did wrong, you went to prison and that was it. And they were going to throw away the key.
I wrote 3 churches to let them know, not asking for anything, that I was reentering back into the community after 10 years of incarceration. And I didn't get a response back.
Both men are now involved in active prison ministries, helping ex-offenders rejoin the community.
I want them to know that they can live normal life once they're out.
It's not easy, though, and the problem is enormous.
More than 2 million Americans are now imprisoned, 4 times as many as 30 years ago. The major reason for the increase, mandatory sentencing for nonviolent crimes and drug charges.
But the war on drugs declared in the 1980s has not had the effect its backers predicted. Arkansas Circuit Judge Wendell Griffin has seen the results.
Drug use has not declined. All it has done is produce an explosion in our prison population. The whole mandatory sentencing guideline mantra was sort of like the Kool-Aid that we should never have drunk.
Behind bars, the racial disparity is striking. Black men are 6 times more likely to be imprisoned than whites, especially for drug offenses, even though the rate of drug use is only slightly higher for blacks.
I have a felony myself.
Law professor Michelle Alexander, author of the book The New Jim Crow, says the nation faces a human rights nightmare more than 40 years after the end of legal segregation.
In cities like Chicago, more than half of working-age African-American men now have criminal records, and they can be legally discriminated against for the rest of their lives in employment, housing, access to education, and public benefits. So many of the old forms of discrimination that we supposedly left behind in the Jim Crow era are suddenly legal again once you've been branded a felon.
In the 1960s, ministers like Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. were in the forefront of the civil rights movement. There's been no similar movement to end mass incarceration.
I think Dr. King would be just so deeply saddened and appalled by what we've allowed to happen in this country in the years since his death.
We're told to visit the prisoners, and so that goes with what we do and who we are.
Tom Navin oversees prison ministries for the Catholic Diocese of Little Rock, but he says Jesus' command to care for prisoners is not widely followed.
We've gotten people to be interested in prison ministry and contribute money to us and pat us on the back, but it's really tough to get people to volunteer to go into the prison. That's really a tough sell.
As an ordained Baptist pastor, Judge Griffin believes churches should lead a national campaign against mass incarceration.
We don't recognize the God in our brothers and sisters who are in prison. And the biblical imperative is for us to see that our sisters and brothers in prison are our sisters and brothers. We owe it to God to get them out.
Just as in the days of slavery, it wasn't enough to shuttle a few to freedom, today we've got to work for the abolition of the system of mass incarceration as a whole. And that means, in my view, that the church has got to find its prophetic voice in the era of mass incarceration and really call on politicians and policymakers to undo the massive tragedy that has been done.
Some legal reform is underway, States from Ohio to California have approved early release programs and lower penalties for lesser crimes, changes driven largely by the high cost of keeping so many people behind bars.
I think Martin Luther King Jr. was right when he said we have to be careful of doing the right thing for the wrong reasons. If we can afford once again to lock people up en masse, nothing will prevent us from doing so if we don't learn the most important lessons from this time, which is that none of us should be viewed as disposable. None of us should be treated as throwaway people, rounded up, locked up, and then branded criminals and felons and ushered into a permanent second-class status. That's the lesson we have to learn from this time, and it's not about saving money. It's about saving lives, saving our own sense of humanity.
If you've got people in prison, they need to be loved too, because if they cannot see the love of Christ in spite of their circumstances, then they'll never come to accept the fact that Christ cares about them at all. How can he care about me when no one from the church is in my life? No one from the church steps forth to give me an embrace.
Talking about congregational involvement requires getting congregations to be about social change. And we in the American religious community have been very, very content to sing our way to heaven. But we have forgotten that in the Lord's Prayer, the word is, "Thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven."
Without more support from faith-based or community groups, many of these prisoners face a tough road. Within 3 years, national statistics say, more than a third of them will be back behind bars. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Deborah Potter in Akron, Ohio.
In other news, a key ruling this week against 7 Virginia congregations that broke away from the Episcopal Church over theological issues and which wanted to retain their property. After a long legal battle, a Virginia court ruled that the church buildings and other properties belong to the national denomination, not the local congregations. The breakaway congregations have been meeting in the church buildings. Unless there's another appeal, the congregations will have to vacate the premises and turn them over to the Episcopal Diocese of Virginia. In North Carolina, victims of the state's forced sterilization program could each be compensated $50,000. The recommendation came from a state-appointed task force and must now be approved by the legislature. More than 7,600 people were sterilized in North Carolina between the years of 1929 and 1974. Approximately 2,000 are still alive. The state targeted people believed to be mentally disabled or physically handicapped. And many other states had similar programs, but most abandoned them after World War II. North Carolina officially ended its program in 1977. In Iraq, thousands of Shiite Muslims continued a pilgrimage to the holy city of Karbala this week, despite a series of deadly attacks targeting Shiites. An estimated 70 Shiites have been killed in Baghdad and en route to Karbala. We take a look now at the week's top religion news and religion's role in the general news with Kim Lawton, managing editor of this program, and David Gibson, national reporter for Religion News Service, who joins us from New York. David, hello. Evangelical Christians in New Hampshire made up just over 20% of the Republicans voting there. In South Carolina, coming up, they probably will be more like 60%. What difference do you expect that to make?
Bob, I think it's going to make a critical difference because South Carolina is really shaping up as a make-or-break last stand for social conservatives. They just cannot get on board with Mitt Romney for a variety of reasons. But social conservatives, these evangelicals, fundamentalists, also can't decide among themselves what candidate they want to back, whether it's going to be Rick Santorum one day or Newt Gingrich. Rick Perry just doesn't seem to be generating anything whatsoever. But if they can't decide, and decide by January 21st, when the South Carolina primary happens, then they could effectively deliver the nomination to Mitt Romney, and then they'll have to decide whether in the general election, you know, if Mitt Romney is not Mr. Right, if it's good enough that he's Mr. Right now.
Mm-hmm. Kim, a lot of evangelicals say they're very uneasy, uncomfortable with Mormonism, with a Mormon candidate. Why is that?
Well, and we should point out that there are a variety of reasons why a lot of evangelicals haven't backed Mitt Romney. His faith is one. A lot of them say they don't trust him on some of their core issues like abortion. He changed his position, or they don't like where he stood on health care some time back. But there is this issue of his Mormon faith. Many evangelicals don't consider Mormons real Christians. Now, that's very offensive to members of the LDS Church who say we believe in Jesus as the Son of God. You know, we believe Jesus was a Savior. So, yeah, we're real Christians. But for some evangelicals, the fact that Mormons don't believe in the Trinity, they believe that God and Jesus were separate physical beings, that's a real difference with traditional Christianity. Mormons believe that God continued revelation in the Book of Mormon. Evangelicals and other Christians, not just evangelicals, Catholics, mainline Protestants, say this is outside the stream of traditional Christianity. So for some evangelicals, that means we don't necessarily want our president representing that. Mm-hmm. Some evangelicals have said that would legitimize a faith which we don't agree with.
Mm. Yeah, David, is there an anti-Mormon strain within Catholicism?
No, there really isn't, Bob. It's not showing up in the numbers. Mitt Romney is doing very well with the Catholic vote so far in the primaries that we've had so far, and he's still polling well nationally with Catholics who just tend to be a little more moderate, I think, in their views. And for them, Mitt Romney is completely acceptable. Perhaps Catholics have a kind of communal memory of the bias that they faced for so long in American culture, and they don't want to inflict that on Mormons as well. And I think that's an irony that Kim was picking up on, that you see evangelical bias against Mormons in the culture and perhaps in this election, yet you see those same evangelicals flocking to Catholic candidates like Rick Santorum or Newt Gingrich, who's a convert to Catholicism.
The big news for a whole lot of people in the religious communities this week was that Supreme Court decision saying that religious organizations can hire who they want to without regard to the anti-discrimination laws. Kim, pick up on that.
Well, I think for a lot of religious groups, the key part of that was without government interference, that the government can't come in and second guess the decisions that they make, especially when it comes to the people who are their leaders, the people who transmit their faith or lead worship or do religious teaching.
People who are ministers.
Well, that's the term, although that's the big question. Who is a minister? And the court left a little open wiggle room in that one. They didn't give a definition. This person is a minister, and that's the concern of some civil rights groups, that this will be interpreted broadly so that the janitor does ministry, therefore he or she is a minister. But religious groups were watching this very closely because they were very concerned about creeping government power, and if the government can come in and say, well, you shouldn't have fired that minister, then that would, they felt, interfere with their religious liberty.
Yeah, David, you want to follow on that?
Yeah, because I think it's a very important decision, a unanimous decision, a resounding rejection of the Obama administration's argument to limit this so-called ministerial exception. And a lot of conservatives in particular are hoping this signals that their signature issue, one of them, religious freedom, will prevail throughout the coming campaign. They're concerned that the Obama administration is trying to curtail religious freedom, that its promotion of gay rights, for example, will impinge on the conscience and the rights of religious believers who are opposed to same-sex marriage. Same goes with these health and human services regulations that are pending that would mandate all insurance plans to cover contraception. That's a real problem for Catholic and evangelical institutions and groups in particular, and they're hoping that this signals that the administration is going to have to back off of some of those plans and policies.
So quickly, Kim, just to sum up, religious groups are more free now than they were before to hire and fire people according to what they believe?
Well, they say that they're free under the First Amendment as they always were. They were worried about the government coming in and changing that in some way. And I think David's right that this has been an issue for a lot of religious groups as the culture becomes more diverse and there are different points of view. How can these religious groups do their faith, exercise their beliefs in a culture that may, you know, largely differ with them? And can they hold those religious beliefs on some very controversial issues like homosexuality or, you know, the role of women? And how can they do that in this context? And so I think they were very pleased.
Kim Lawton of Religion and Ethics News Weekly, David Gibson of Religion News Service. Many thanks. Finally, on his travels around the world, Fred DeSam Lazaro has found some unusual religious practices. One of them is in Ghana, in West Africa, with its joyful funerals for Christian believers and so-called fantasy coffins, each a work of the carpenter's art, each representing the lifetime achievements of the deceased. Fred's report is from Ghana's capital, Accra.
Saturdays are set aside for funerals in Accra. In the numerous congregations that line the streets and alleys, the air is filled, at times with prayer, most times with song, blaring at its electronic limits. And nowhere, it seems, is there any outward sign of sorrow or grief. With few exceptions, like the death of a young person, my host here said that's the way it is.
When somebody dies in Christ or dies a Christian, it's a good thing because he is going to God. He has died on a good path. But when somebody dies a pagan or somebody who does not know God, then people cry because his soul is lost.
We saw little evidence of any crying on this Saturday, and it would be hard to discern a lost soul. The vast majority of people in this city strongly profess some form of Christianity. About 16% of Ghanaians are Muslim. Most of them live in the country's north. Funerals are major social events that bring together far-flung extended families. Obituary flyers and posters cover neighborhood walls. Often they are anticipated years in advance and say much about a person's status. Nowhere is that more evident than in the coffins favored by the Ga ethnic group in southeastern Ghana.
People who have achieved in their lifetime.
Well-to-do.
Well-to-do. And usually it has to show you one's area of achievement. If one were a fisherman, they would show some canoe or fish or things like that. If you're a driver and you own transport, it means they will show some transportation.
We saw coffins waiting for the next crab fisherman, hunter, or could this one be for an animal lover? There's one for the beer lover, farmer, and athlete. Fantasy coffins have gained a reputation for their high art. Many are sold to foreigners and collectors. At the root of all this is a strong tradition of honoring, even worshipping ancestors, says Ablad. Grand funerals are a way for the living to please the newly departed elder, to continue the communion with those who went before, and to ask for blessings.
And the belief is simply that the ancestors are there, and if you're going to meet them, you must meet them properly. I mean, his being there becomes a blessing to the family. They will call, soon start calling upon him to also, hey, send us something. This week, things are not too good.
In fact, funerals, even without the expensive fantasy coffins, are a huge financial drain on families, providing meals and libation for dozens, sometimes hundreds of guests, the musicians, and of course, the morticians.
The family will pay this money with interest. Maybe the person has left children behind, or he has left some properties. Sometimes it has to be auctioned or sold to defray the debts which has been incurred.
There are calls from time to time from religious leaders to cut out the excess. But here, funerals are an investment in harmony with one's ancestors, a true measure of one's esteem for the departed. How, many families ask, do you put a limit on that? For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, this is Fred DeSam-Lazaro in Accra, Ghana.
That's our program for now. I'm Bob Abernethy. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook, find us on YouTube, watch us anytime, anywhere on smartphones. There's also much more on our website. You can comment on all our stories and share them. Audio and video podcasts are also available. Join us at pbs.org. As we leave you this Martin Luther King Jr. weekend, music from the Boys Choir of Harlem.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company. The estate of William J. Carter, the Jane Henson Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Be more. PBS.